Session number 20308, Reel 4.
And now that left four of us, and myself is five, and we met another prisoner who turned out to be the fly in the ointment. He started thieving things from the Italians. I didn't like the man from the word go. Anyway, I was out one day wandering around the countryside, and when I got back, all our kit in this cave had been strewn all over the place. I had a very little, I used to smoke a pipe in those days. I had very little of any kind of tobacco left. That had gone for me. A couple of things I'd had made out of the plastic wrappings in the Red Cross parcels had gone. They were, in other words, they were hand-woven belts. And my wife had given me, when I left, a complete shaving and washing kit in a leather case. That was strewn all over the place. And the razor I found, but nothing else. I was most disappointed about that, because that was the only memento that I'd got from home with me. Anyway, two of the others, and I think I'm right in saying they were sexually involved, let's put it that way.
Sexually involved with whom?
With each other. In other words, they were
homosexuals.
I'm sure of it, but they were nice lads, and I could do nothing about that. They went off on their own. I thought, right. One afternoon when the three villains were out, I went to their kit and looked in their kit, and lo and behold, there were the two plastic belts in their kit. So I knew then who'd been through our kit to get the tobacco, a little bit of tobacco that I'd got, because I was lucky in as much as at that last prison camp I received the only Red Cross parcel I ever had from my mother, and it was full of food, chocolate, pair of boots, underclothes, things like that. And of course I'd put on the boots and the underclothes when I left, and I couldn't eat the I couldn't eat the cake that she'd made, because someone had put a bar of soap in the box, and everything edible in that box tasted of soap. However, having found out the circumstances that I was now living with three villains, I started scouting the area on my own. I used to go out all day looking for somewhere suitable to hide up on my own. I was going through a little village called Schito, S-C-H-I-T-O, only four houses, and a barn. And a little Italian, who he hardly came up to my shoulder, came out and, in Italian, he said, "Eh, inglese o americano? Are you English or American?" I said, "English." "Eh, hai fame? Are you hungry?" "Yes, see." Took me indoors. His wife cooked me, I think it was half a dozen fried eggs, gave me some bread and some vegetable I didn't recognise, and talked to me all the time while I was there. He said, "Italy will lose the war." I said, "Would you stay here? Because I think it would help me with the British if I looked after somebody." I said, "Yes, please." So I went back that night, picked up all my equipment the following morning, what I'd got, never said a word, and just left them. Now, I found out afterwards that those three got turned out of that village, messing about with the young girls of the village, because, now, once more, I'm no prude, but I avoided doing that because, and it was easily done, if I'd messed about with that girl there, and her fiancé's parents knew, they would report me to the police, and that's exactly what happened. They got out just in time, apparently, but they were thick and idiotic and nasty pieces of work. Anyway, I stayed with this little family. I worked on the land. By the way, the farmer who spoke to me had built those four houses himself. He could make cartwheels, he could make barrels. He could cope with half a dozen jobs, which in this country would be a single job for a man. And yet he was uneducated, he was just a little peasant, quite honestly. But he was a marvellous little man, and his wife too. His brother, Santi, his older brother. What I used to do, I used to eat in his house one day and Santi's house the next day. So they spread out the food that way. The third brother, who was even older, was tended to be a fascist. But he was threatened by his brothers. If he gave me away, they'd kill him. And they meant it. So he didn't get on too well with me. I had a couple of meals in his house, that was all. And I used to sleep in the barn. I've slept up in the hayloft. I've slept down with the cattle. The little chap I was living with had two little daughters, 8 or 9 years old. I'll go ahead on this bit now. When I left them, those two little girls cried their eyes out because I was leaving. When our troops came up, I had to go south. That was a year later. They grew up, they got married, they had children, they emigrated to Boston in America. I went out to see them 3 years ago. They looked after me as well, if not better, than my own family. And now in their 60s, when I flew home to England, those two women cried their eyes out because I was leaving again. So some good things do come out of a war. Now they've got my phone number. I will guarantee one of them is on that phone once a month to see if I'm all right. And the daughter, who's now 30, is always contacting me on the phone to find out how things are going, because if she's got a joke she can tell me, she loves to phone me and tell me the joke, and I tell her jokes that I can tell her. Not risque ones, but, you know. And we get on so well together, all of us. However, let's jump in the gun a bit. I've picked up acorns for the pigs. I've hoed the grapevines. I've tied the grapevines up. I've picked the grapes. I've crushed the grapes down with my feet. And I've drunk the vino. And being teetotal before the war, I could drink a whole pint glass full of vino and it had no effect on me. Whereas other prisoners I met afterwards would only have to have half that amount of vino and they'd be drunk. Now I think, because they used to be the ones who used to knock back the beer in the nappy, there's an alcoholic content somewhere in the body after that stays there and only wants arousing. That's the only description I can give to it. However, one day I'm picking up these acorns, and one of the daughters who wasn't there with us came down and said, Sydney, there's a man at the farm at the house. He wants to talk to you because he says you understand Italian. Now I thought, hello, is this somebody who wants to see me, or is it a German, or is it an Italian? I took a chance. I went up there, and it turned out to be someone called Major Nightingale, South African Forces. He'd been a camp follower in the Boer War. He'd been right through the First World War, World War, going up from private to colonel. He'd falsified his age and got into this one. He'd been captured in Tobruk, the same as me. He'd escaped, of all things, his name was Nightingale, and he'd escaped from Florence. But because he'd been wounded in the First World War, he was blinded in one eye, he had a glass eye. When he escaped, he dropped this glass eye in the dark and couldn't find it. So he'd heard that there was an Italian ophthalmic surgeon who had a house near where I was hiding, and he used to visit sometimes for a weekend, because the Germans used his ability and they didn't mind him doing that. So would it be possible for me to contact this ophthalmic surgeon to see if I'd fit him up with a glass eye? So I said I'd do my best. Anyway, I managed to get hold of some more prisoners I knew where they were hiding in the area, a couple of Air Force chaps and a couple of Army chaps, and one other, I don't know what regiment he was with. I wanted them to act as lookouts. And I went down to this place where I knew this doctor or what a surgeon was there, and he agreed to fit up the colonel with a glass eye. We made an appointment, and I got all those four or five blokes on the high ground around the place to give warning if necessary if anybody was coming. And I met the major, and in we went. It took us into his study. Now, you know when you go into a museum and you pull a drawer out, shall we say, the butterflies, they all open out one and we did this in his study, and there were all these glass eyes staring at us. Brown ones, blue ones, green ones, dark ones, light ones, big ones, small ones. It was always a real sight to see them. Anyway, fitted up the major with a glass eye and a spare. And then he said, would you like a glass of wine? Now, we got used to drinking this raw wine made on the farms. And we said, yes. He took us down into the cellar below the house, and there were these great barrels of wine. And he opened one. He took some crystal, real beautiful crystal glasses down to drink out of, and he filled it up. Oh, it tasted like nectar. Oh, it was wonderful. I like wine now, don't I? I'll have to have wine when I get home, because I never did like beer anyway. Not that I was against it, I just didn't like it. Would you like another glass? And finished up, we had three glasses of this wine each. Now, I had about 3 miles to walk back to where I was hiding. I knew that the hills went up and down, and didn't realise they moved like this. I was pissed for the first time in my life. Anyway, I got back. The little farmer realised what had gone on. They used to make their coffee with burnt acorns. He made me a great pot of this black coffee and made me drink it. Then let me go out and sleep it off in the loft. Anyway, that was my introduction to real good wine. Another time he came to me and he said, look, he said, I know there's going to be a drop from aircraft of equipment for the partisans. He said, and they've asked me to be involved. He said, but it means we've got to have more officers with us. So I said, well, what do you want me for? I'm a gunner. He said, oh, yes. He said, but you speak Italian, and you've proved to me that you're a sensible bloke. There are two ex-officers in my prison camp who are living, I think, at that place you can just see on the edge of the mountains there. He said, would you go and get them and see if they'll come down? He said, mind you, they're not very nice people. They're officers, but they're not very nice people. So I said, okay. Well, because I love dogs, the farmer's dog would follow me everywhere. And although I had about 7 or 8 miles up and down valleys and all the way around to get up to this Garula Sopra. There was a Garula Soto, Garula Sopra. That's Lower Garula and Upper Garula. And I had to get to Upper Garula. They made me up something to eat. The dog came with me, and I had a bottle of wine, and I took a bottle of water for the dog, and off we went. Well, I had to cross the only road between me and the foothills. The only road that wound round and up all the way to Sartanan, or the name of the nearest little village. Big village to them. And I had to wait to make sure there was no movement of traffic or anybody walking along there. I chose my moment, ran across the road into the woods, the dog with me, and we kept going. We bypassed Lower Garula in case there was anybody there, went round in the woods past it, and I got up to within reasonable distance of Upper Garula. I went into the village and made inquiries. No English, no British, no. Because they didn't know that I was German or not, obviously. So I thought, well, I've still got plenty of time. I went and sat under some trees outside the village where I could see up into the mountains, and I could see a little hut under some trees. And then the hut opened, the door opened, and out marched two gentlemen, left, right, in step, all the way. I knew they were our officers. I mean, I had to learn to walk like an Italian and not swing my arms in case I was seen. They walked like this in the countryside. They hardly moved their arms, so I had to do the same. And I followed them. I saw which house they went into. I knocked on the door, and I explained what I wanted. I needed to see the British officers. No officers. I said, I can see them. They're there looking at me through the window. Didn't get much response, and they just disappeared. So I left them a note. Major Nightingale needed your services. He's asked me to come over and get you to go down to meet him. I have often heard the phrase, officers and gentlemen, You are obviously officers. You're certainly not gentlemen. I left the note with them and left with the dog. Now, on the way back, I've got to cross that road again, but I take a different route. I'm not going back the same way that I came. I'm trying to go back in a more direct route to cut out all the bypassing I had to do. And I get above this road, down below me, about 40 yards lower than me, and I sat under some trees. I can see most of the road coming this way and miles of the road that way. No transport. So, right, time to cross. So I slide down this slope, the dog with me. I'm halfway over the road and a German staff car comes round this corner. It must have been in dead ground. They must either have been stopping for a pee or having something to eat. I thought, oh God, that's it. I went down the other side. It was like a precipice. When I looked at it, I could not understand how I got down it. But the car hadn't stopped. It had gone on. Obviously, they saw me scuttle across. Possibly thought I was an Italian. I hope they did. By then, I was wearing a cap and a civilian jacket, and my battle-dress trousers had been dyed black, you see. Anyway, I got away with that. I went back to Major Nightingale by appointment, told him what had happened. He said, I'm not a bit surprised. Not a bit surprised. Useless couple of... Well, I won't use his words, but they were useless. Then again, he told me he'd got a meeting with the partisans, and if I'd like to go, I could. So I once more crossed this road some weeks later and inquired where the major was. And I, of course, I ran my head into a brick wall. As far as they were concerned, they didn't know me. Major Nightingale hadn't warned them that I was going there. Well, he was there, and he came out and found me. And said, well, you've been waiting all this time. I said, yes, they wouldn't let me come. Oh, he said, all right, I know they're worried. And he said, they're paura, they're afraid. So I said, yes. Well, he said, thanks anyway. And he said, what you don't realise, he says, there's a chap over there behind you in those trees with a gun in case you are a German. So I got away with that one.
Were partisans very active in this area?
The partisans were taking advantage of the simple life of the local population. What would you do if you were a little farmer and an Italian came in with a rifle, plonked it on the table and said, get me something to eat? That was the partisans. So they were as much a nuisance as the Germans. I was hiding... Oh, I didn't always sleep where they expected me to sleep. I did sleep in the cattle stall. One night I went to the cattle stall, and what kit I'd got, I used to keep in a sack under some straw. And it was strewn all over the place. Oh, God, someone searched the place. So I went back into the house, because the cow, was tied up to the wall. And... I'd said what had happened. They went back with me. No, they went back on their own, the two brothers. Came back laughing their head off. The cow had got away, got the rope off, and it was that had scattered my bedding all over the place. However, I also slept in a little cave on a small escarpment just off the road from the where the houses were. But in the meantime, I thought, now, if the Germans were to come in the night, these good people, one of the children, are going to come down to tell me. And the Germans, being what they are, most of them are reasonably sensible, are going to wonder where that child's gone, and they'll be here as well. So I made myself a place up near the church on the hill, on a shelf, with a drop that side, and bushes this side. And I used to keep some bedding up there. I also kept my sack up there. Now, what I used to do on those nights was lay the blanket on the ground so that I could lay on half of it and turn the other half over me, but with my feet in the sack. One night I woke up, my feet were cold, they felt wet, it was not raining. So I took my feet out of the sack, and out jumped a bloody great toad that had been hiding in there. I no sooner realised what it was, and it jumped over the escarpment, followed by a snake. The snake would have been there in there as well if I hadn't found the toad.
How did you come to get your liberty?
How did I come to get my
freedom?
When our troops came up. Eventually. Have you ever heard of Popsky's Private Army? Well, it was him and his little group that came to the little town near me, and I went down into the town to greet them.
Which town was it?
Sarnano. S-A-R-N-A-N-O. It's now a ski resort. It wasn't any more than just a small village, really. I remember the sergeant in Popsky's, one of the sergeants in Popsky's Private Army, as it was called, saw I got a pipe and I'd been smoking Italian leaf tobacco, but it was so strong, because they used to grow it on the farm, that we had to boil it 5 or 6 times to get a lot of the nicotine out, else I couldn't smoke it. Even then it was strong. Anyway, this sergeant gave me an unopened tin of Three Nuns. Now, normally I used to smoke some Bruno Flake, but Three Nuns under these conditions, I wasn't going to say no. But, you know, when I put it in my pipe and lit it, I couldn't taste it. So I had to, when I was using that Three Nuns tobacco, put some of this rough Italian leaf tobacco with it so I had a decent smoke. Anyway.
What impression did Popsky's Private Army make on you?
Well, I've never heard of them, of course, but they explained to me, and they did what the SAS did, round behind the German lines and then back through, firing at anything that moved.
Do you remember the names of any of them?
No, I don't. No. No, I didn't get the names, I don't think. Just talked to mainly to this sergeant.
Do you know the date that you were freed?
Well, when I spoke to the sergeant, I said, now, are you the advance party? He said, oh, yes, we're well in front of the other troops. Don't head south until you see our transport coming up. Then he said, you know, there's no Germans between you and Naples or whatever. And that's what I did. It took another week or two. Because prior to this... My farm was on a hill, but the slope of the hill went down into a valley and stayed there when there was this drop down into the road down below. So I could lay here in the trees and watch the bend in that road. So when the German transport started going north, I began to wonder what was happening. Then the wounded were being taken north in ambulances. Then the marching troops were going north. I thought, oh, they're finally going further north than here. And then there was a pause of about 3 days. I saw some transport coming miles away I'd never seen before. They were jeeps. Well, we never had any jeeps when I was in the Middle East. And it was Popsky's Private Army. And then I and an Air Force sergeant that I got to know, who was in hiding some couple of miles away, said, right, now's the time to go, we'll head south. And we did. We walked about 12 miles, and we were picked up by a lorry driven by a Polish woman. I've never had so many scares in my life. She travelled at about 60 miles an hour, even round the bends and the precipices. Anyway, we got down to Bari on the Adriatic coast. We were taken to a camp there, and we found out that no matter what we did, the military police would pick us up if it was something illegal, or if we were drunk, etc., etc. They would not be able to do anything with us but take us back to the camp and leave us. We were not to be charged with anything. Well, some of them used to get away with murder. One chap had got a bowler hat and a long beard, because we hadn't shaved months. And they used to bring him back on a regular basis, pistols and newt, every night. Yes.
Did the authorities treat you properly?
Our authorities? In that circumstances, yes, I suppose they did. They left us to our own devices, provided we didn't do anything stupid. But the annoying thing was, when you went to go to a cinema, there'd be two queues. One for the American troops, one for the British troops. That included us, ex-prisoners of war. The Americans would be let in first. When there were no more Americans and there were enough seats left, used to let us in. And I always remember there was a lovely club there. I never got into it, but taken over by the American forces. And the big notice outside saying, American soldiers only, no soldiers. No, American troops only, no soldiers. That was us. We were the soldiers.
How do you feel now about having served in the Royal Artillery in the war?
Well, I suppose if you've got to be called up, it was as good as anything. I mean, I didn't object to the discipline, but I only objected, as I still do, when something unfair is done. I don't know whether it's because I was born under the sign of Libra, but I hate people who cheat or use authority unnecessarily. Like we had one sergeant major who was a Green Line conductor. He used to treat us like dirt because this is the first time he had authority. On the other hand, as I say, Sergeant Major Boss was a very nice man. I told you I was married on embarkation leave. When I got back here, my first wife had been killed by a flying bomb 4 days before my return, she and her parents. That cut the floor from under me for a while. And whilst I was in this country, I wouldn't take any stupid orders at all. I actually refused to do guard duty. I said, no, I've had enough of that. I used to guard Brighton Pier early on. I said, I've done guard duty on the Italian prisoners in Cairo. I said, I've been behind wire for God knows how long, and I'm not doing guard duty. They sent me to see a psychiatrist, who when he heard my story, and not only was my wife being killed, but my mother, when I was captured, had had a nervous breakdown, and my father was ill with cancer, he agreed that I had every right not to do guard duty. And from that moment on, I didn't. All I did was referee football matches, umpire or playing cricket matches, until I was demobbed. I was finally sent to North Holt Aerodrome Map Reproduction Unit.
Where had your wife lived when she was hit by the V1?
Roehampton, not far from here.